Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. Going postal. That's one of our focuses today on It's Our Money, another example of how public institutions are frequently best suited to most efficiently deliver public services. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute, and Ellen's co-host here on It's Our Money. We're going to be building on Ellen's recent article discussing how the Postal Service could bring about a dramatic improvement for about 25% of Americans who don't have access to simple banking services, and who, as a result, spend up to a tenth of their annual income paying exorbitant fees to get their checks cashed, to send money, deposit funds, and more, and why this lack of service for the essential utility we call money is such a scourge for those who live in places not served by the private banking industry for one reason or another, like inner cities or rural areas, and how the virtually ubiquitous public asset known as the post office offers such promise to correct a long-standing inequity within our economic structure. As you'll hear in a moment, this saga of postal intrigue goes way back to the big banks who can't stand competition and who could care less, frankly, about public service. We'll talk with Catherine Isaac, a leader of the Campaign for Postal Banking, and we'll be talking with another candidate for governor who's building a public banking platform into his campaign in Rhode Island. Matt Brown has just announced his candidacy, and he's got big plans for the state, many of them predicated on the creation of a new state bank. And later on, Ellen discusses a whole new approach to addressing the systemic dysfunctions of our economy with Cooperation Humboldt, a locally based effort to model cooperative economic principles. So let's get started and talk with Ellen.
Well, Ellen, you know, you're back on the printed page again this week with a discussion of a lost public institution that everybody used to use. This is about a public bank that existed at the post office. The name of your article is The War on the Post Office.
Well, we went to a round table at Ralph Nader's in January, and Catherine Isaac was there, and she handed out this journal article that was the whole history of postal bank. It was called Banks of the People, The Life and Death of the U.S. Postal Savings System. But what was so interesting about it is that it's pretty obvious that the banks have been at war with the postal service all through the 20th century. And somebody is still at war with the postal service. They're obviously trying to kill it. The tour de force was in 2006, there was an act that was passed by Congress that required the Postal Service to pre-fund health care for their workers 75 years into the future, which is unheard of. I mean, nobody else has to do that. So basically, you're paying for health care for workers that are, you know,
not even born
like
yet.
Three generations of workers, yeah, that haven't been born yet. So somebody's out to get them, trying to privatize them. But if you read this history of the Postal Service, the banks felt threatened immediately. The Postal Banking Service was established in 1910. It was after the bank panic of 1907 when people didn't trust the banks and they needed a safe place to put their money. So immediately after it was established, the American Bankers Association established a sort of a counter committee that was, the whole goal was to prevent this idea from spreading. And you can see what a threat it really is if you look at China, where their biggest retail bank is actually their postal bank. It has, I forget, like 500 million customers, you know, customers all across the country, and they're doing lending, they're not just doing postal orders like we're used to banks doing, but they actually are doing retail lending And nobody can compete with them because of the business model, which is that you don't have private profits sucking out the resources of the business, but the money actually goes back into the banks, so they can cut prices and still pay people decently and hire enough people to do the work.
I noticed in your article that as far back as the late 1800s, the support for the postal banks kind of united a nationwide coalition, as you say, of workers and farmers who believe that government policy should prioritize their welfare over private business interests.
Right. It's basically, they know that we've got the numbers, and if we can get organized, we will win and we'll overthrow the big money, but they've got the money. So that's how they exercise their control, and they're not going to relinquish control easily or willingly. The Postmaster General did a paper in 2014 on how the post office could fund itself and expand its services by going into various postal banking services, including doing
payday lending.
Yeah, payday.
Check cashing.
Including payday lending, which are small loans that right now that people are paying, like, I think it's 381% interest on average. So they could do payday loans, according to the Postmaster General, for 28%, which is still, you know, that's not a low interest rate, but it's way lower. It's like one-tenth of what they're paying now. So it would be a good deal for the borrowers. And, of course, you have to have a high interest rate if you're going to cover payday loans, which are people that have no collateral. They may not get their paycheck at the end of the month. You don't know that you're going to get paid. So it is a risky form of loan, and the way you overcome risk is you raise the interest rate to cover defaults. So anyway, it could be a profitable deal. But that would take a change in the law, and with this Congress, that doesn't seem likely to happen. But what they can do, as Catherine pointed out, is to expand the services that they are already authorized to do, which would be basic sort of taking in money and check writing and dealing with those welfare payments that now come on a card. So you have to have some way to cash the card. So people are paying big fees for those.
Yeah, there are a lot of street level services that they could do. And then there's, what, about 25% of the people are underbanked or unbanked. So there's an enormous need for a much more people-oriented public service. We always talk about money as a public utility, and yet it's doled out like a private commodity. This is a terrific opportunity for that to change.
Right, and the reason that it's still able to self-fund is because of this increase in business for Amazon and other Internet merchants. But the problem is they don't have the money to hire more workers. So you've heard the term going postal. It's really stressful to be a post office worker these days. And a lot of them, I guess, are getting these stress-related injuries. So you have women that have to tote these huge packages. Anyway, they need more people working there. And then drones, they're trying to expand their deliveries themselves, which means they might cut the post office out of that work. So they do need another source of income. The post office is the only business-like entity that's actually in the Constitution. I mean, it's been around as long as the country has. Every little town has its post office. Even if they don't have banks, they have post offices. So it's a great opportunity. You don't have to build a lot of buildings. You just set up an extra window at the counter there and do these simple basic things. You don't want to do mortgages or anything complicated, but just the very simple things that the unbanked want to do.
Yeah, and of course there are, what, about 30,000, if I get the number right, postal offices around the country. Is it? The point is that they are almost in every town in America. It's a civic meeting place and a centering resource. It's a great resource. That's why the private parties want to take it over. You know, I mean, isn't that really the trend? The unending desire to privatize all of the public assets is really what's in the target here for knocking the legs out from underneath the Postal Service.
And many other services, yeah. Somebody wrote me an email and said that instead of saying privatization, we should say profitization, because that's what
Absolutely.
It's all about. turning it into private profit. One reason, these post offices are getting sold off, too, and they're the ones built in the 30s are just beautiful buildings. That's what Roosevelt was able to do with Keynesian economics that everybody makes so much fun of, but they put the money out there first, and they build all this stuff, and then the money comes back because they are self-funding loans. They are loans that do pay back. So those beautiful buildings that are really should be classic public property are being sold off.
Yeah, you pointed out that the postal savings system came into its own back in the 30s when Franklin Roosevelt was taking steps to mitigate some of the impact of the private banking system's collapse. I noticed that in your article it says alarmed bankers called it the postal savings menace and warned that it would result in the destruction of the entire private banking system. You know, it's really funny. We talk about the big bad banks, but man, are they ever defensive. The minute you talk about stepping into their territory, they really jump all over you. And that's what they're doing that on the public banking initiative. But here with postal banks, they're doing the same thing. This is what we need to do now with the postal office, isn't it? People need to step in and take a stand for it.
Right. I think with that populist movement that got started in the 1890s, it's about time we won. We've been at it for over a century.
Although the public banking thing is happening in a very exciting ways in so many new places. I mean, we're just seeing it all over the country as cities and states get serious about looking into this. But I would want to point out that the banking lobby is always there to react and like scared cats. That somebody's going to be challenging them, and they just don't want to have anybody in their profiteering space.
Right, and they always say, you want government to run a bank, they'll lose our money, they'll be making bad loans. But look at all those banks like in China that nobody can compete with the Chinese postal bank because it's too good of a business model. I just talked with David Cobb about in our interview coming up that we're not going to survive unless we learn to share and become like one entity in communication with each other and cooperating rather than competing, that we've been made to model of competing with everyone and it's us against them.
Mm-hmm.
And winners and losers, that model is, could argue, some have argued that that's been imposed on us intentionally in order to keep the people from getting together. But
Right. People
don't want war. People don't want to fight. They really want to get along. They want to share. They want to cooperate.
Yeah, and there's no scarcity. That's the other myth. We talk about it many times in this program. The myth of scarcity is what perpetuates this dependence on debt. But I do think that that's not going to take everybody to read the writing on this wall. The time is running out. Then that we're fully capable on our own as people to make systemic changes that will allow the abundance of the community and of our ability to work communally and collaboratively to really carry the day forward. If we wait for the banking lobby to align behind our interests, well, we'll all be dead.
And on that note.
On that note, exactly.
Well, you could argue that the reason we're faced with all these traumas and fears is that's what motivates change. That it's a good thing.
And it's a very exciting thing, and I'm delighted that public banking is really at the forefront of this because money is so central to all of our capabilities. The people have got to get their hands on their money, and that public banking and postal banking will be methods through which that will happen.
And it should appeal to this administration because they're all about less regulation, letting business operate in a free and fair, unfettered environment. We should let the public services operate that way, too.
Well, let's bring it on, Ellen. We'll see what happens next, huh? Thanks so much.
And thank you.
The Post Office is one of America's great legacy institutions. established in the Constitution to serve and connect the people in our widely diverse land. And as you just heard, up until a few years ago, it provided essential financial services for these far-flung citizens. Now it appears the post office's future may be tied to its past. Our guest is Catherine Isaac, assistant to the president of the American Postal Workers Union and the director of the Campaign for Postal Banking. I asked her when this campaign got started.
Well, it started in 2015, which was about a year after the United States Postal Service Office of Inspector General released this really fantastic report saying that the Postal Service should look into the possibility of postal banking. And the campaign came together to work to push both the Postal Service from a grassroots perspective, but also sort of internally through the postal union bargaining process, so to get them to move on the idea. And so we're doing some grassroots efforts. We're starting some petition campaigns around the country. And we also, the American Postal Workers Union, won a task force in the last round of bargaining. And so we're working with postal management to try to figure out ways to move this forward.
And there are several unions representing postal workers. What are the other ones? And are they on board with this?
Yeah, all four postal unions are definitely on board. The National Association of Letter Carriers, the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the Rural Letter Carriers. We all see it as a way to use the existing infrastructure of the Postal Service to expand services to the public. So the Postal Service has a mandate. It's called the Universal Service Obligation. And the mandate is to serve every household in the country and to provide services at fair and reasonable rates. So we think this is another service the Postal Service could add that would greatly serve the public and also help strengthen the Postal Service.
A lot of people just assume that the Postal Service is an arm of government, but that's not quite right, is it?
It's quasi-governmental. So in 1970, it used to be a department of the federal government and a cabinet-level department. And that changed in 1970, and it's now sort of expected to run itself like a business. It gets no taxpayer dollars for running the operation. It all comes from the sale of stamps and shipping packages. And it has a board of governors that's appointed by the president and approved by the Senate that helps run the service. And I think a lot of people don't know that part about the taxpayer funding not being there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet Congress has the ability to put the whole operation in a noose and tighten the rope.
Yes, exactly. And they did a really good job of that back in 2006 with a bill called the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. And basically what that did was it said, you're not going to get any taxpayer dollars. You can't offer any new products and services. We're going to limit your ability to set your own rates. And on top of that, we want you to pre-fund your future retiree health benefits 75 years into the future to the tune of about $5.5 billion a year. And so that pre-funding mandate really put the squeeze on the Postal Service. So no business would have to operate that way. No business does. And no other federal agency has to pre-fund in that way either. So that's really where the problem started with cuts to service, cuts in standards, cuts in service. That's kind of all the Postal Service felt that they had left to them. And that's really where that IG report came about, saying this is potentially another source of revenue while also giving another source of purpose to the Postal Service.
It's a clearly malicious step, and it makes you wonder, well, what would be behind that in your view? Why would Congress undermine, knock the legs out from underneath our Postal Service?
Personally, I think it's ideological, right? I think it's the idea that government is bad and the private sector can do it better. And so if you starve the Postal Service and make it look like it's a public entity that's failing, it really fits into that ideological position.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to take the offensive on this and show what it could be doing instead.
Tell us about what services would be possible at the community level if you would be able to implement postal banking. You're able to do this without any further legislation. Is that correct?
That's correct. So the vision would be, and this is what happens in lots of other countries, right, is that it really is a postal bank, and it could do full-service banking, right? It could do payment products, it could do savings, and it could do credit. But because of that mandate that we can't offer new services, we've started looking, and the OIG was looking, at the things that could be done under existing regulatory and legal authority. And that's what our campaign is focusing on right now as sort of a first step to moving toward even more financial products.
So would it actually be a depository bank? People would be able to put their money there, or just
well, you know, services? From 1911 to 1967, there was a postal savings system, and folks put their savings there. That would certainly be something we'd like to bring back, but that could not be done without an act of Congress. So the campaign for postal banking, the first phase is to win the things that don't require Congress to act right now, that could be done today if the Postal Service would act. So the campaign's trying to put pressure on the Postal Service to do these things. And those include payment products like being able to cash your paycheck, use an ATM to retrieve government payments such as Social Security without a fee. That's what we'd like to see in the post office. You could also do bill payment, like local utility bills. We could do international money transfers and domestic money transfers. Those are all things that would be building on products that already exist, like money orders and electronic funds transfer.
And, of course, very important services that cost people in inner cities who are unbanked, about one out of four Americans, apparently, they're critically
needed. About 25% of all U.S. households are what's called underserved by traditional banks. And those aren't just in cities. It's also in rural areas. And I think that's one of the things that is so unique about this idea. There are post offices everywhere. There are 30,000 post office branches, and you compare that to about 5,000 Walmart stores. And they're in places where there aren't banks or there are very few bank branches. And so the infrastructure's there. It belongs to the people, and we want to use it to help folks out who are paying way too much to banks or to payday lenders or, you know, those kinds of businesses.
You mentioned ATMs. Feeding an ATM and sort of falls to a banking responsibility, doesn't it? Would a public bank in a community or a city be a helpful backdrop for that idea?
Yeah, that's why I think this is such an exciting potential partnership, right? I think there are lots of things that the Postal Service could do, but they would need some sort of bank on the back end, right? And so what a beautiful partnership that could be to have the public bank be the back end for the retail services that the post office could provide.
I understand you've got some locales targeted for some initial steps in this regard.
We do, yeah. So the campaign is doing a petition campaign in Cleveland, Baltimore, the Bronx, and soon we'll be picking a more rural location. And we're collecting signatures to deliver to the local postmaster demanding that the services be done soon. And those will be then delivered to the Postmaster General, who ultimately makes the decision.
So what can people do then? How can folks support this?
Definitely go to our website, campaignforpostalbanking.org, and sign the petition to the Postmaster General. And if you're in one of those cities, we'd love to have you get involved as well. Send us an email, follow us on social media, and we'd love to have all the support.
That's Catherine Isaac of the American Postal Workers Union. Visit their postal banking campaign website at campaignforpostalbanking.org. Well, if you follow public banking at all, you've certainly heard about the new governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, who is moving forward with creating a state bank to help that economically beleaguered state. He won in a veritable landslide, and he ran with the state bank idea front and center. Now, other gubernatorial candidates are emerging who are supporting a public bank for their states, this time in Rhode Island. Matt Brown, who served as the state's Secretary of State, intends to use the public bank there to enable the financial resources that are needed to drive an ambitious agenda for energy and economic recovery. I spoke with Matt Brown about his interest in using the public bank concept.
The level of interest at the state executive level in public banking is a relatively new phenomenon, and you've adopted it. But what's your vision for running for governor in Rhode Island, especially as an independent?
Well, people here in Rhode Island have been struggling for a long time, struggling to pay for the essentials in life, to afford their health care. We've struggled to provide a good education to all our kids. We're dead last in the country for education and opportunity for Latino children. We've got a $200 million deficit. So people here have been struggling, and we need new ways to create good jobs that are can't be outsourced, to create an economy with real and lasting prosperity, to bring people together. People are very divided and polarized, and we got to bring people together to do these things. So we put out some bold ideas to make those things happen, and we're starting to go across the state and talk to people about it, and also to hear their ideas about what we need to do to solve the problems we're facing.
Incorporating public banking, it's something that many people don't, perhaps most people don't know about, but how is that playing, and how do you feel that fits into your agenda?
Well, the response so far has been very positive. I mean, it's a new idea for most people, and so we're talking with people about it. But I think people understand that we need new ideas, and we need bold ideas, and we need to do things differently, because the status quo has not been working, not just for the past 3 or 4 years, but for the past 3 or 4 decades. So I think there's an openness and even a hunger for doing things differently. And this idea of starting our own bank and bringing our money back from Wall Street and investing in the state is one that makes a lot of sense for Rhode Island.
And what do you hope to be able to accomplish with having your own bank?
Well, right now in our state, the government takes over $2 billion a year in taxpayers' money and gives it to Wall Street banks. And those banks, in turn, invest it all over the country and all over the world and make profit from that. But the one place they don't invest our money is in Rhode Island. And so what we want to do is take that more than $2 billion a year back from Wall Street, put it in our own bank, and invest right here in the state, invest in creating jobs, invest, for example, in starting the first fully clean energy system in the country, which would create up to 10,000 good jobs that will be around for generations to come. Investing in affordable housing. We have an affordable housing crisis here. Too many people just can't afford their housing. Invest in supporting small businesses, which really struggle here to make ends meet. So the idea is to have a new way to invest in the Rhode Island economy and to invest in a way that earns some profit. And with that profit, we can invest more. So it's a different source of revenue for investing in the state and meeting the state's needs than what our government offers us now, which is only the options of either raising taxes, going further into debt, or what is happening here a lot, which is what they call raiding or scooping money from critical services to plug the budget holes. So this bank would be a new way to generate revenue to meet needs in the state. For decades, we have been unable to provide every kid in the state a good education. And we've been having this conversation for decades. I mean, I ran an organization called City Year 25 years ago where we had young people as tutors and mentors in the schools. And we were talking then about the problems of the schools. And we're having the same conversation now. Housing, as I mentioned, has been an ongoing problem here. And these problems aren't being resolved. And I believe that the bank would be a new source of investment and revenue that could help us solve some of these problems that have plagued the state for a long, long time.
Do you see it as a direct agency of the state, run by the state, or do you see it as an independent kind of a agency that doesn't You know, I mean, the concern, one of the concerns certainly around the country is that, well, should we give the quote-unquote the politicians a bank, you know? And there's a certain amount of pushback that automatically comes with that that notion. And yet, of course, the other side of the story is that, well, do we want to give Wall Street our money?
No, this would be an independent bank, regularly audited, highly regulated, strict oversight, the opposite of Wall Street, for example, you know, in other words. You know, now we give our $2.5 billion of taxpayers' money every year to Wall Street banks, and they, you know, they really run the table. I mean, they're, as we know from 2008, they're taking this money and they're taking all kinds of risks. They're essentially unaccountable to anyone. They're involved in all kinds of global financial schemes like they were in derivatives last time. They're still doing that with our money. So that's the risky place to put our money. The safe place would be here at home and have it be independent, highly regulated, audited, and run not by politicians or bureaucrats, but by professional financial managers who know how to make investments. And the last thing I'd say about it is this bank would have a charter and a mandate to invest in Rhode Island, create jobs, grow the economy, solve problems, and it would do that in partnership with local banks and credit unions, the way that Bank of North Dakota does. So that's yet another layer of essentially security and safety. We'd be talking about safe local loans that are done in partnership with local banks and credit unions who are vetting those loans themselves. So you really have a double vetting and checking process. Again, really the opposite of Wall Street, which is doing things with our money that we have no idea what it is. It's totally opaque. This would be absolutely transparent and accountable.
Well, you know, Rhode Island has this wonderful seashore. You guys are right on the ocean. And part of your vision is about a new kind of an energy system that you see is completely renewable. Would you talk a little bit about what your vision for that is and how your public bank might be able to make those things happen?
Yeah, Rhode Island has enough renewable energy resources, wind, solar, water, to provide not just all of the energy that Rhode Island uses, but twice that amount. So my goal is to have the state be the first state in the country that that produces all of its energy through renewable sources, totally clean, renewable energy. But not only that, is the first state in the country to produce enough renewable energy to export it to other states as a source of revenue. So this is the biggest economic opportunity in generations. We're talking about creating a new energy system. And this will create up to 10,000 jobs. These are jobs that cannot be outsourced, good jobs, good paying jobs. It would create revenue for the state for generations to come by exporting energy. It would obviously be good for the air and the water and the environment. And so the role of the bank here is to invest in this in a way that the bank and the state get a return. Because, you know, what happened the last time we had an energy revolution was the discovery of fossil fuels, and big corporations and big banks took total control of that system, and they took all the profits forever. So ExxonMobil made $122 million a day just a few years ago. That was their rate of profit. You know, I don't think that any corporation or bank should be able to own the sun, the wind, and the water. It doesn't belong to them. The people should get a return on an investment in our natural resources. So the bank could invest and have a stake in creating this new energy system. And some of the profits would come back to the bank, and that could be used to further invest in the state and solve problems that we need to solve in the state.
And clearly, that big vision of a whole new energy system and a profitable one that actually exports energy is an ambitious financial objective. And as you point out, we're not going to be able to borrow this from Wall Street and get ahead. So it seems like an either-or proposition. Either we're going to fund this ourselves, or we're going to be back in the same debt taxes cycle. It's been a very exciting frontier, and I appreciate that you've been Secretary of State of Rhode Island. You have a deep, widely acknowledged success and stature in state politics, but by the same token, you understand that the parties are enormously powerful. How do you feel that running as an independent is going to attract the synergy that you need to pull this forward?
Well, I think what we're going to need to pull these kind of ideas forward is a lot of public involvement and public backing. Yeah, the public has, I think, been dissatisfied for a long time with the political system. And so, well, we want to go out to all the people across the state, regardless of background, regardless of political viewpoints, people who may have disagreed with each other in the past. And we want to say, look, we're putting forward ideas that are not really on the current political spectrum. They're really just new ideas. You can't put a label on them other than to say that they're bold and they're practical at the same time, and they get at the roots of the problems. And I think that's what people are looking for, and so we want to take that case to everyone in the state. And, yeah, we only have 1 million people who live here, Walt, you know, and we live in pretty close quarters. It's a pretty small place.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a place where you can go out and talk to everyone, which is what we need to do, because these are big ideas. We're talking about big changes. I think people are looking for big ideas and big changes, but we're not going to get these across in 30-second TV ads, and we're not going to win this in the kind of the negative politics that have really overtaken our political system over the last 3 decades or so. We're going to win this by going and sitting down with people in their homes and having real conversations about the problems we have and what the causes of those problems are at their roots, and these ideas that we're putting forward, and also, like I said, listening to other people's ideas. So that's how we're going to run this campaign, and we've just gotten started with it.
Well, how do people get involved with this initiative?
Well, come to one of our many house parties we're doing across the state. They can go to mattbrownfordgovernor.com or check us out on Twitter or Facebook, Matt Brownford Governor. And come to a house party. They're open. Everyone's welcome. And I'll be there and we can talk about it.
That sounds great. If you weren't so far away from me, I'd join you. It sounds like you're creating a great conversation for a new prospect for Rhode Island. And thank you for the initiative and that work, Matt, and also for taking time to be with us.
Thanks so much, Walt. Thanks for your leadership on this issue.
That's Matt Brown, a public banking candidate to become Rhode Island's next governor. Find out more about his campaign at mattbrownforgovernor.com. And now, Ellen's discussion with David Cobb.
I'm speaking with David Cobb, an attorney turned political activist who co-founded Move to Amend and was the Green Party's candidate for president in 2004. He was also Jill Stein's campaign manager for her presidential run in 2016. His latest project is called Cooperation Humboldt. It's great to be talking to you, David.
The pleasure to reconnect with you. I feel a
right.
certain kinship with you and your
Right, and we're both recovering lawyers.
Yes, I often use the phrase recovering lawyer. It makes me chuckle that you do as well.
I probably got it from you. I forget. So your latest thing is Cooperation Humboldt?
Cooperation Humboldt is a local group in Humboldt County, California, dedicated to proving that we can meet all of our needs without exploiting or oppressing anyone, and that we can do so without allowing anyone to exploit or oppress us, and that it can be done in an ecologically sustainable manner. Now, I know that's big picture, but that big picture vision is really important because too many times the work that we as social change agents do get caught up in merely tactical considerations or what we think is possible within the current system. We are trying to be very clear about our call to restructure society, but that we can do that starting where we live, work, and play in our own community. So within that notion, we have created a set of program areas. That is, the things that we need not just to survive, but to thrive. And our program areas are food production and distribution, shelter and housing, health care, art and culture, finance, and energy infrastructure and other institutions. So within those program areas, our effort is to create organizations or work with existing organizations to democratize them, to actually prove that we can get that those things can happen outside of an economic system that is premised upon the private ownership of the means of production and the idea that everything must be and needs to be associated with the idea of maximized profit.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's cool that you've added art and culture in basic human needs, because on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we always think of the bottom rung as being food and shelter and health, but really we are cultural beings. We need art and we need association and all those finer things.
We can survive with just enough food to eat and clean water to drink and a place to live, but we can't thrive. We can't actually be the fully human that we are if we don't include art. And we include art and culture because we understand culture to be beyond merely the medium of art, but culture as being everything that we do. One of the things that we are very concerned with is to begin to move from the dominator-exploiter model, from dominator to collaborator, to move from a power-over dynamic to a power-with dynamic. And we think that unless you have a culture, which is not just the organizational and mechanistic structures of how you make and implement decisions, but unless the culture, that is how you treat each other every day, changes, we will simply replicate the exploitive oppressive patterns in a nice new box.
Uh-huh. My daughter's thing is biomimicry. We've interviewed her a couple of times, and she says, and I've read in Elizabeth Sartorius's book, that we are not like individual entities. We really are a superorganism, that we're like ants and bees and termites, or at least we have that potential, and that we're like on the next rung of evolving into this superorganism. And particularly like the internet, it seems to me, has brought everybody together so that we're sort of one mind. I mean, you can find any information you need. You can get to know people just by seeing them in videos, you know, other cultures, let's say, or you can stay in contact with people on the other side of the world. So we're just growing into this big beehive, but you're right, we have to set up new systems in order to get the beehive to work.
And I'm grateful that you brought in the notion of the internet, because it really is a way to democratize information flows. Helen, again, as recovering lawyers and as people who understand that there are laws in place and that there are economic systems in place and then there are cultural barriers in place. And one of the things that Cooperation Humboldt is attempting to do is at the micro level, wherever you live, you could begin a process like we're doing at Cooperation Humboldt. And I do want to challenge the podcast listeners to go to the website, cooperationhumboldt.org, take a look at what we're doing, and then reach out to us. If you are doing something similar, then let's build a network, because I do believe that ultimately the process that you described earlier in terms of transitioning / evolving into this super organism is going to require a level of cooperation and humility, because I am genuinely and sincerely inviting constructive critique on our experiment.
I was listening to your TED Talk on your Cooperation Humboldt, and you mentioned something about it was possible to set up a free food forest. So how would you make this free?
Yes. Well, imagine if in all of our public spaces, and by that I mean not just parks and other public areas, but I also mean right-of-ways. And imagine if in your own community, the local community park and all of the trees, imagine that those trees were now fruit and nut trees, and that the harvest would be available to anyone and everyone. Imagine along sidewalks at homes, you were growing fruit trees and nut trees and figs and so forth. Again, ultimate goal would be that food was so plentifully produced that it was not merely a commodity that was created, bought, and sold at a profit, but instead was being created and shared completely without the need for money. That's the basic vision and concept of an urban food forest. And there are a couple of examples of very well-developed experiments that are happening now basically doing that. The one that comes immediately to mind is in Seattle at a very large public park. In addition to that, imagine the idea of what we are calling food walls, where in high-traffic public places there are walls on a slight incline where along the wall, laterally growing, are radishes and herbs and various types of lettuces. And the idea would be that just take what you want when you want it. You know, these are the kinds of things that we are beginning to work as very concrete projects. Any one of them, Ellen, is not going to completely transition away from a capitalist economy to a solidarity economy. But the idea of treating and creating food as a right that we are creating and sharing together is, we think, the linchpin for thinking about it. Another project that we're doing in the idea of food that's moving towards the urban food forest is what we call little free pantries. You and your podcast listeners are probably familiar with the little free libraries that are beginning to spring up, which are absolutely delightful. There's one very near me that my partner and I poke our head in, and we've taken a book and we've given a book. Wonderful idea. Now imagine doing it with non-perishable food, so that the idea is that we are creating structures and processes to be able to share food, not just with people that you know, but even with pure strangers, because we're creating a network of being able to do that. So these are the kind of concrete projects and programs that we're doing under the program area of food production and distribution that would ultimately lead to, we hope, an urban food forest.
Wow.
Another of our projects we call Farm My Yard, where we are beginning to identify people who have backyards or maybe even front yards where they don't either have the time or capacity to do gardening, and then match them with people who do not have access to land to be able to actually begin to garden in these spaces where people want it but don't have the time or labor capacity to do it. And the only thing that we insist on is that there not be money exchanging hands, that there can be, you know, food, the food that's produced gets shared, but that nobody ends up in a labor relationship or a sharecropping relationship. So,
wow,
you know, all of these things really simply require a different psychological, mental, dare I say, spiritual orientation to the work that we do.
Right. I heard somebody talking about Yugoslavia before, you know, when it was in its heyday, which really was pretty much the ideal communist society. It was like kind of half communist, half... Anyway, it worked. Yugoslavia worked, unlike Russia, I guess. And that there were fruit trees growing along the just along the roads, and you could pick fruit. And it sounded very like the Garden of Eden, and it was a mindset thing. That was just... It belonged to everybody, and everybody could share. In fact, I'll say about that here in where I live, it's all condominiums. So in effect, you don't own anything except what's inside your walls. But on the other hand, you own everything. And so you've got all these grounds that you could walk around and in between people's houses, and, you know, you don't feel like you're trespassing or anything. Whereas I have a friend who has a much more expensive house in Beverly Hills, but all the houses are blocked off. They all have walls or great big hedges so you can't see in. So if you go for a walk, you're in the street. You're really out in the street with the cars. Anyway, there's much to be said for sharing a lot of stuff. Instead of feeling like you don't own anything, you can feel like you own everything.
I am so glad you used that phrase, because I have actually been trying to get people to think about ownership in that way, that shared ownership actually means we all own everything together. And it really is simply a mindset. And I do believe that in this current historic moment that we are in, we are either going to win everything and win a new world based on this vision, or we can't win anything. The old ways are dying. The system is literally beginning to collapse. And I'm not fighting to try to save this dying system. I'm fighting and struggling to create an entirely new system, a system that's based on love and compassion and kindness and generosity. That is the very essence of a solidarity economy.
Yeah, that's great. You co-founded Move to Amend, and we used to hear a whole lot about that, but it's kind of dropped out of the news. So I just wondered how that was going, or if you've abandoned the pursuit, and that was another case where you were up against very powerful forces.
Well, certainly we are up against powerful forces. I'll remind your listeners that Move to Amend is an organization dedicated to a constitutional amendment to abolish in its entirety the illegitimate, court-created, made-up, and completely ridiculous idea that a corporation must be treated as if it's a person with inherent and inalienable rights. And, of course, as a lawyer, Ellen, you know that if you have a legal or constitutional right, it means that government cannot infringe upon that right. And if a right is denied, then you have a remedy under law. So the idea that a corporation has constitutional rights allows corporate lawyers to go into court to challenge literally any law that you can imagine on the grounds that that law somehow violates the corporation's constitutional rights. It's how environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, public health laws, and campaign finance laws are challenged and frequently, sadly, overturned. So Move to Amend was created to educate people about this concept and to build a concrete campaign to amend the U.S. Constitution. I'm proud to be one of the co-founders. There were 12 of us who founded that organization back in 2009, just before Citizens United. Today, there are almost 500,000 people actively involved.
Wow.
There are statewide networks all across the country. Our proposal, House Joint Resolution 48, has been introduced into the House of Representatives. There are 53 co-sponsors of that effort. So it is still ongoing. And I think that as big as it is to think about amending the U.S. Constitution, that's not big enough. I actually think we need an entirely new legal, political, and economic system. Make no mistake about it, Ellen. At some point, I think that we're going to actually need an entirely new constitutional framework that guarantees, as a matter of right, access to health care, access to food, access to shelter, what are called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through the United Nations. Because what we know is in this country, when people think about rights, they're almost always thinking only about political rights. But we do not have constitutionally protected economic rights or human rights. And what I'm trying to do is to change that concept.
That's great. That's a tricky thing, though. I think that's even trickier than changing the banking system. Just wondering how we're going to do it. I, too, want to do it. I just don't know how to pull it off.
The reality is that all I know how to do is what's in front of me. So I have a vision, a goal, and then I make plans, which are called strategies, and then I employ tactics and specific things to do in service of the strategy in order to advance the plan to ultimately achieve the goal. One thing I do know is this, Ellen, you cannot achieve a goal if you don't have a plan, and you can't have a plan if you don't actually do things. So this is the spirit in which Cooperation Humboldt exists, which is that we're actually trying to do things, but we're also very open to changing our strategies and changing our plans based on new information and based on lived experience as we go forward.
Well, what we could do is a new, like what Roosevelt proposed, which was an economic Bill of Rights. So we tacked the Bill of Rights onto the Constitution.
I know that you said that as an offhand quip, but actually, if there was an organization attempting to adopt the economic Bill of Rights, I would be an active proponent of doing exactly that.
Right. And then you have to figure out how are you going to pay for it. If everybody has the right to health care, how are you going to pay for health care?
So I'll tell you, Ellen, and my short answer is we actually can't pay for any of the things that we need under the capitalist model. If we had a solidarity economy model, however, we could pay for all of these things and more. What I know is this. The problems that face us today are no longer technological problems. There are solutions to climate change. There are solutions to poverty. There are solutions to lack of health care. None of these things are being implemented because of the economic system known as capitalism and a political system in which the wealthy and powerful, and by that I don't even mean the 1%, I mean the 0.001%, the billionaire class have convinced us to fight each other over issues that we don't really even have that much power or control over. So I am absolutely committed to building a broad-based, multiracial, multi-ethnic mass movement that is demanding that we restructure society so that everybody's needs get to be met. If we had a system like that where everybody was in and nobody was out, and we eliminated completely the idea of the profit margins of insurance companies and big pharmaceutical companies, literally, right, we would save trillions. And I did say trillion with a T. Trillions of dollars would actually be saved over the course of several decades by utilizing that approach.
Right. And you could pay for it with quantitative easing for the people. Basically, let the Fed issue the money.
Right. Yeah. I do want to underscore that at Cooperation Humboldt, we exist to help build a solidarity economy across the area where we live. We're identifying and supporting and nurturing cooperative economic efforts that are going to help people meet their needs without exploiting or oppressing anyone, without being exploited or oppressed by anyone, and to do it in an ecologically sustainable manner. We believe that our current institutions are fundamentally racist, sexist, and class oppressive. We think this is a result of social, political, and economic systems that are incentivizing domination and exploitation over women, people of color, poor, houseless people, undocumented, and indigenous people. We also believe that capitalism itself is an economic system based upon the profit motive and exploitation and oppression, and that if we do not change this economic system into one that is cooperative and sustainable, that we are literally going to destroy the planet that we depend upon for life itself. And lastly, we believe it is possible to create new institutions that incentivize cooperation, love, compassion, and kindness. This new system can be and will be supporting every person with a quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds great. Very inspiring. I'll be looking at your website more thoroughly. Okay,
well, thank you so much, Alan. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you and all the folks at Public Banking Institute for what you do.
Okay, and thank you.
That was David Cobb of Cooperation Humboldt. Visit them at cooperationhumboldt.com, where you can see David's TED presentation. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.